Listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, online at WFMU.org. Up next, we've got Ask Alan. It's been a really wonderful show. Going out with one more brand new from Baby Rose that pretty much sums up where we ought to leave off today. In my opinion, much love to y'all and much love to yourselves. Continue to give it.
I can only give you love that lasts forever. And a promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those I am sure that I've told you, they would give you the toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and the love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear. You'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore, that's all. That's all.
Today's special is Memphis Soul Stew. We sell so much of this, they gonna make some Frisco hot stew. Give me about a half a teacup of base. That's our bass player from Macon, Georgia, Gerald Jamont. And now we need a pound of fatback drums. Bernard Purdy, ladies and gentlemen, on the drums. And 4 level tablespoons of ball and Memphis guitar now. Carnell Dupree from Fort Worth, Texas on the guitar. And now we need a little pinch of organ.
I love that intro. I love the whole thing. Welcome to another episode of Is It Soup Yet? My name's Alan Harding. I'm the chef. I've even played one on TV. And I'm here today to talk about food to y'all. Today we're going to got a kind of a mixed bag show. The first thing I have to throw out is a trivia question. And it's a couple tiers to the trivia question. One, does anyone know what mignonette sauce is? If you know what mignonette sauce is, you're a winner. If you know how to make it, you're a double winner. And that's going to be the trivia question for today. You can throw that out there in addition to whatever else you have to enthrall me with food-wise today. My current fascination with food has led me down the dessert path, believe it or not. I have a great friend. I have a great friend who has a donut store in upstate New York. The name of the store is Fred's Donuts. If you're ever there in Tannersville, try Fred's Donuts. And the interesting thing about Fred's Donuts is they make their donuts fresh every day. And whatever's left at the end of the day goes in the trash. So my buddy gave me the leftover sack of these apple cider donuts. And some of these donuts were glazed with cinnamon sugar, which I love. And I'm looking at this big bag of donuts, and I'm saying, what am I going to do with these donuts? And I came up with bread pudding. Now, if you know what bread pudding is, then I got you. If you don't know what bread pudding is, I'll tell you basically what it is. It's bread that's toasted and broken up into pieces and mixed with eggs, sugar, cream, milk if you don't have enough cream, and some vanilla. And then the bread is inundated with this custard mix. And if you're smart and you know what you're doing, you're going to bake it in a water bath. In French, that's a bain-marie. It'll go in the oven and cook at a moderately low temp, like 250 degrees, maybe 300. I like to bake it covered. But my bread pudding that I made with Fred's Donuts, I decided I wanted to have raisins in it. A lot of people have very strong feelings about raisins. I love raisins. And my favorite raisin is a golden raisin. And what I did with these raisins that I bought at the supermarket was I took about 6 bags of chai masala tea, just regular off-the-shelf chai masala tea. And I put that in about 3 cups of water. And I put a piece of sliced ginger in there. And I boiled the tea until it got nice and flavorful. Then I threw the raisins in. And the raisins drank up all this wonderful chai masala mix. And they plumped. And then I strained out the liquid, mixed those into my donut bread pudding, baked it covered it with plastic first in a metal pan. Yes, you can put plastic in the oven. Then I covered it with foil to make sure all of the moisture would stay inside, and I baked that for about an hour and a half at 300 degrees. I took the lid off right at the end, raised the heat, and voila, I made the best bread pudding that I've ever had, and I put it on the menu as Fred pudding, F-R-E-A-D, Fred pudding. No sauce, just a little whipped cream. Bada bing, bada boom. So that's my bread pudding story. If you got anything to talk about, including the trivia question of what is mignonette sauce, and bonus points if you know how to make it, you can reach me at 201-209-9368. We're at beautiful downtown Jersey City at WFMU in the studio. And if you have any thoughts on bread pudding or mignonette sauce, we will get at it. Get at it. The other thing, you know, I don't really prepare much for this show. I have to admit, I have, although I just started with a little notebook, because all these thoughts and all these things that I want to talk to you about come to me, and I'm like, yeah, I'll remember that. I'll remember that. And then when I get here, I'm like, I don't remember anything. So I now, since I'm old, I write things down, and I remember them. So we have things to talk about. It looks like we have a caller. Two callers. Hey, what do you got for me today? Talk to me.
I'm hoping that I know what mignonette sauce is.
Well, only you would know that.
Yes, it's a vinegar sauce that you put on your oyster.
Excellent. Excellent. And what distinguishes... excellent, excuse me. Excellent. Ooh. You answered the question correctly. And someday when we have T-shirts, if we ever have T-shirts, you would have won one if we had one. You're getting a virtual T-shirt for knowing what mignonette sauce is. But can you tell me what the ingredients are in mignonette sauce?
Well, I know my aunt makes one. We like to have our little oyster days every once in a while. And she uses a champagne vinegar, a shallot, and I believe there's some pepper in there, but that's all that's in hers. I don't know if yours is a little more fancy, but she said you're supposed to make it the day before.
I like making it the day before. I've never made it with champagne vinegar. That sounds delicious. I like to use aged red wine vinegar, and you don't have to make your own, but bonus points if you do. We have another caller. Thank you. You're on the air. Talk to me.
Yes, I'd like to circle around and let's talk about you using plastic in the oven.
Yes, I
what
use...
What kind of plastic? Are you talking like plastic wrap?
Plastic saran wrap, if that's an acceptable term. But I use saran wrap that comes from the restaurant supply store, which dispenses itself out of an 18-inch wide container.
And so is it made of a different kind of plastic?
I don't know where plastic comes from. I think it comes from dinosaurs. I imagine this comes from dinosaurs, too. The plastic doesn't touch the food. It covers the food, covers the pan that the food is in. And I'm not well-versed in the outgassing of these kinds of things. I just know that we've been using plastic wrap in the kitchen for a long time. And I haven't been served with any papers for any lawsuits yet. It's a low
That's
temp.
Good.
It's a low temp, and pretty much it's the plastic is intact when I remove the. I protect the plastic from incinerating or melting with aluminum foil, and I like to double up the aluminum foil when I do that, and I crimp it around the edges of the pan very tightly, and. Whenever I take the foil off, the plastic's still there, so I haven't done anything wrong yet.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Maybe you could do like a silicone lid? I'm thinking like how I would cook that at home, but...
Well, when I made the Fred pudding on Saturday, I used a 18-inch... cast iron skillet that my grandmother gave me that I've had for years. I don't know where I'm going to find a silicone lid for it, but you know what? I'll look into it.
Okay.
Thank you for your call. Thank you
Thank
for
you.
Safety first always in bread pudding. We have another caller. What is enthralling you today?
I mean, this conversation about the plastic wrap, honestly, if you got to ask what it made me call is that it just sounds like it's going to melt to me. Are you sure?
Pretty sure, yeah. I'm pretty sure it hasn't melted. Did I mention that I like to keep the oven like between 275 and 300 degrees, which to me is not a very hot oven. I like to cook the custard very slowly and gently, much as you would do a creme brulee, because it is eggs and cream and sugar, and it basically steams itself. It's a very low temperature. The plastic has not really melted. I mean, I don't wrap the whole pan in it. I just cinch it around the top and then pad that with the aluminum foil.
It's got to be culinary grade is what it is because you're getting it from the restaurant supplier. Because if I just put saran wrap off the shelf, even in a 275 oven, I think it would melt. But I don't want to take up any more of your time, man.
Thanks, brother. What do you got for me besides the potential hazards of melting plastic on bread pudding?
The joy of the amount of green that's going to come in behind all this moisture we've been enduring in the Jersey City area for the last couple of weeks.
That is quite spectacular. I live in the Catskills. We call this mud season. And usually mud season ends the last week of May, but we're still in the middle of mud season in East Jewett, let me tell you. But I can't wait. I can't wait for the plants to grow. I have a lot of tarragon and a lot of cilantro growing.
Oh, that's nice. We're doing the basics. We just got tomatoes and basil because it's easy to do in the windowsill.
Love tomatoes. What do you got for me? Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, mignonette sauce. I only use
triple score if you can spell it.
Subpar, because I like to taste my oysters. But oftentimes it's served. There's two of them, right? There'll be like a pickled red onion type of flavor, and then there'll be another one that's like. I don't know, it's more verdant, you know, it's like green and sometimes it has like little bits of a jalapeno or something like that in it.
A verdant mignonette, that's news to me, although there are a bunch of other sauces that you could use on oysters. I like simple as well. I'm not a big fan of cocktail sauce. If I do make cocktail sauce, I have to use Heinz chili sauce, which is very hard to find. I don't even know how they make it, but it's a great base for a cocktail sauce. Hello? No, nobody? Okay. Crickets. We got crickets. That's okay. Mignonette sauce. I mentioned making my own vinegar. When I was in the restaurant business, I'm still in the restaurant business, but and around November every year, the Beaujolais Nouveau comes out, which is everyone's favorite red wine. I can't hold it. I can't stand Beaujolais Nouveau. But the good thing about being in the restaurant business and buying Beaujolais Nouveau is they send it to you in these like little barrels, or they used to anyway. And I would always save the barrel after all the Beaujolais Nouveau was dispensed and use it to make vinegar. And vinegar is, you know, I don't want to lapse too much into organic chemistry, but vinegar requires something they call a mother, which is like a snotty bed of should I say bacteria? I don't know if it's bacteria or not. I think it's a beneficial it's a flora that will multiply and eat things. Fungus. It's a fungus. I just heard. Fungus. Vinegar mother is a fungus. And you can't make vinegar without fungus. And the vinegar, the fungus, if that's indeed what it is, since my engineer is not an organic chemist either, he's fishing. The mother goes into the barrel, and you have to feed the mother. Usually that requires sugar and old red wine. If you have any old red wine, that goes into the barrel as well. The sugar eats the fungus, and the byproduct is vinegar. And if you're draining your vinegar barrel entirely, you have to make sure that you don't drain it of its mother, and you have to remember to feed it. It has to be replenished with wine, and it takes a while to recoup the spent red wine into the vinegar itself. So, you know, if you have some time on your hand, have some time on your hand and you want to try your hand at making vinegar, I strongly suggest aging it in wood, which is what the barrels come from. Make sure that it's a small barrel because you don't want to have a lot of, you don't want your vinegar barrel to take up a lot of space. So, again, the phone number today, as always, is 201-209-9368. And in addition to the mignonette sauce trivia question, for which you're going to win a virtual T-shirt or a T-shirt of some kind whenever we have them, which will probably be never, you have the satisfaction of having done a job very well, which is always good to know. So the bread pudding, or Fred pudding, as I call it, my current fascinations. I must pat myself on the back. I think I have perfected barbecued brisket. I'm going to go out on a limb, and before I did this, I've been making brisket for a while. I have a commercial smoker at my spot. It's called a Cook Shack, and it is an electric smoker. and it has like a element in the bottom that you slide this little coffin on top that you put wood chips in. And don't get me going about wood chips. I don't want to talk about wood chips. I think all wood chips basically do the same thing. I have yet to notice the subtleties and vagaries of the different fragrances of wood. I use, right now I'm using pecan wood. And the only reason I'm using pecan wood is because I found a 50-pound bag of pecan wood chips in the restaurant basement that someone bought and never used. And that's what I'm using. I'm using pecan wood chips on my brisket. And I will say, since I'm afforded the luxury of going into the minutiae of smoking brisket, a couple things you want to remember about smoking brisket if you're going to smoke brisket yourself. One, the brisket has to be at room temperature. Can't be cold. It should be room temperature. Second, if you've ever seen a brisket, a whole brisket in its raw form, it's quite large, very large, to be exact. I'm going to say between 12 and 15 pounds. And the brisket has two qualities. One is a flat part at one end that we'll refer to as the flat, and the other end is more is girthier and fatter, and contains a lot more muscle and fat, and that's where most of the fat on the brisket lies. I do believe fat belongs in brisket, but I do denude my fatty end of the brisket prior to cooking. And I will have to say, let's say we're talking about a 13.5-pound brisket, I will remove approximately 2 pounds of fat. I never weighed it. I just throw it away. But I remove the 2 pounds of fat, which leaves a thinner cap on the brisket, of which, after that has been removed, I score it. Scoring is lightly etching a crosshatch pattern in the brisket. I do that with a very sharp knife, and I don't go too far deep into the brisket. Then I take kosher salt, a good quality kosher salt. Diamond Crystal is an excellent brand. Actually, they're probably all pretty good as long as they're kosher. Definitely not iodized salt. We'll spend a day on iodized salt in the upcoming weeks. I would like to admonish everyone, if they have a round iodized salt container in their spice rack or their pantry, to throw it away immediately. And this will be illustrated by, when you have your kosher salt and you have your iodized salt, you pour a little onto your cutting board, wet the end of your index finger, taste the iodized salt, rinse out your mouth, and then taste the kosher salt, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Iodized salt is horrible. It tastes, it burns the tongue. And it is a salt bomb. It's very difficult to season with iodized salt. Much easier to season with kosher salt or sea salt. But I use kosher salt for my brisket. I take, these measurements are arbitrary since I'm making a big batch of seasoning salt. I use, well, just so you have a savage idea of the recipe, let's say I take 2 cups of kosher salt. I put that in a bowl. Then I take 2 cups of whole black peppercorns, fresh peppercorns, Malabar, if you must know. Although I'm a great fan of Szechuan peppercorns, haven't tried that with the brisket. Malabar or telecherry, if that's the way to pronounce it, is a good entry-level fresh peppercorn. Take 2 cups of those. Then I take the peppercorns and I put them in my little Braun, if I can say Braun, coffee grinder that I stockpile from my frequent forays to garage sales in the Hudson Valley region. If there's ever a Braun coffee grinder for sale, I will pick it up because they don't last that long. I'd like to put the 2 cups of peppercorns into the Braun coffee grinder and grind them into coarse ground black pepper. And basically, if you don't know what coarse ground black pepper is, it's basically if you looked at a peppercorn and broke it into 6 to 8 pieces, that would be coarse pepper. I like to go a little finer than coarse. I mix that 2 cups of black pepper with the 2 cups of salt. To that, I add 1 cup of cracked coriander seed. Coriander seed, not coriander powder, okay? Coriander seed, which is the seed of the cilantro plant, if you must know. And the best coriander seeds, we were discussing this earlier in our pregame, the best coriander seeds are obtainable at a Indian supermarket, and they're light and they're pale. They're not the if you know coriander seeds, they tend to be brown and cumin colored. I like the lighter coriander. I find it to be fruitier and more delicate. So I take we're up to 2 cups of salt, 2 cups of black pepper, 1 cup of coriander seed. Mix that well. And then I take my 2 pieces of brisket, one of which is the flat and one of which is the bulbous end, which has yet to have a name, but it's the opposite end of the flat. And I generously coat both sides of the brisket with both sides of the room temperature brisket. I've severed the flat from its fatter brother. Side, season both sides of the product liberally with this product, with the ground hence called spice mixture, and then from there, I also make sure that I get the ends, the cut ends, you know, so all 4 sides of this brisket is covered with the spice mixture. And then it goes into the smoker, my smoker being a Cook Shack. Now, you could have any kind of smoker you want. You could also probably do this. I don't recommend doing it on hardwood. It's too hard to control the heat. And heat is the enemy of a good smoked brisket. My Cook Shack is set to 225 degrees. And the highest the Cook Shack goes up to is 250. Now, if you know anything about organic chemistry, you know the temperature at which water boils is 212 degrees. Now, the end result, when this is all said and done, I would think the word moist, would play predominantly in what you want. You don't want your brisket to be a briquette, which would come from too high a temperature. Because at too high a temperature, the water that is inherent in the brisket will boil and will immediately turn your brisket into shoe leather. Now, why the water inside the brisket doesn't boil at 230 degrees or 240 degrees, I have no idea. Water boils at 212. Maybe the internal temperature never gets that high. I don't even use a thermometer. I've never used a thermometer with the brisket. I use my hand. And I will say that my brisket, the last brisket I cooked on Sunday, I put in the oven at 10:30 and I took it out at 6:30. So how many hours is that? That's 8 hours. Now, if you follow the brisket blog, whatever, they're going to say 12 to 14 hours. I don't know. It was done. I pulled it out. I took the fatty part of it, cut a little slice. Didn't taste like rubber bands. It was delicious. It was smoked. I had to replenish the smoke tray twice to make sure there was enough smoke in the cabinet. And the other thing that I did with this brisket, and that I am chagrined to say this in lieu of the earlier calls, is I wrapped the brisket tightly in saran wrap after it came out of the smoker. And I'm going to say the internal temp, if I had to guess, was 140, 150. I wrapped this brisket very tightly in plastic. I've heard a lot of people, there's a very famous place in Austin, Texas, called Franklin. And I think what they do there, don't quote me, is they wrap their brisket when it comes out of the smoker in peach paper. Peach paper, if you know anything about the restaurant business, is butcher's paper, which they have on a big roll behind the counter when you go to the butcher shop. It's the peach-colored one. Not the white one that they wrap the peach-colored one after they get your meat. The peach one doesn't react with the meat for some reason, and it lets it, it retains a lot of moisture, and it's very thin, and I don't know where you get it. I don't know where anyone's going to buy it, but if you have that, have at it. You can wrap your brisket in the peach paper. In a pinch, you could use parchment paper, but my brisket at that point is done and ready to be held. I hold it in a low oven, basically a warming cabinet, which has a temperature that goes up to 150 degrees and has a little moisture in the bottom, a little water tray, so it stays moist. I hold that in there during service, and I've never had any problems. It's delicious. Delicious to the very end. And if there's any brisket left from a service, that's the first brisket that gets used the next day, and it's even good the next day. So anybody have any thoughts? Kowalski, are you out there? Kowalski, is anybody out there? Because we need to talk about some things. The phone number, 201-209-9368. And if you're not near a phone, or if you don't have a phone and you only have a computer, if you want to pitch me some potential topics to talk about in this forum of one, I'd be more than welcome to listen to what it is you have to say. Writing down my ideas as we speak in a little marble notebook that I keep with me, try to keep with me on a regular basis. And my recipe for brisket's in there. My mignonette sauce recipe has always been in there. And my newest recipe is for Fred pudding with the chai masala spices. Someday we'll talk about chai masala, which is my favorite coffee beverage. I love a dirty chai. I made chai once from scratch, and it was delicious. Oh, we have a caller. My friend, talk to me.
How did you know?
I had no idea.
Oh, everyone can be your friend. Listen, that Fred Blue is freaking brilliant.
Thank you.
Was that really innovative on your part, or is it based on other things? Because I thought it was genius. I've never heard anything like it.
Well, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Right.
I only have on the menu at the spot one dessert, and it changes on a daily, you know, whatever. I make a batch of something. When it's gone, I make something else. Someone gave me, my friend Ed gave me a can, believe it or not, of rhubarb. And I was thinking, yeah, what am I going to do with this rhubarb? I didn't want to open it until I knew what it was. And I was like, should I make rhubarb bread pudding? And then my buddy Cody came by with a bag of donuts. I was like, oh, damn, I'm done. I got it. And I had the eggs. I had the cream. And I should say, if you're going to do sugar and eggs for this Fred pudding, it was double the amount of yolks as whole eggs.
Okay. And yeah, I'm not going to make it myself, but I love hearing about it, and I love your passion for it.
You know, what was it that George Peppard said in the A-Team? I love it when a plan comes together. And being gifted a huge bag of donuts, it's not a curse. I mean, I ate my fill of them, and I still had a lot left over. And those apple cider donuts are absolutely delicious in bread pudding.
Right. I want to say some about bread pudding and rice pudding. My mother used to make both of those things starting from the late 60s. I remember loving the rice pudding. I think we poured maple syrup on it, and there were always raisins in it. You could be eating anything at the table and say to my mother, hey, you know what would be good in this? Say, what? I say, raisins. And she'd jump up and grab the raisins.
Raisins get a bad rap. You know, but they're the fruit that is when there's nothing left and there's nothing in the larder, there's always a box of raisins somewhere.
That's true.
And yeah, I love it. And you piqued my interest when you said rice pudding. If you had your mother's rice pudding recipe, I would love to hear it, because I know how to cook a lot of stuff.
Unfortunately, I don't, but I doubt it was very complicated. I'm sure it was just milk and eggs and rice and raisins. And on top of it, I think she would sprinkle nutmeg or cinnamon or both, but that's probably about it. I don't think, vanilla. You got to put vanilla in the mix. And I think that's about all there was to it.
Yeah, well, God bless your soul. Don't embark on a rice pudding career based on what you just told me, because, you know, the rice has to be cooked, right? Yeah. And then after it's cooked, it has to get turned into pudding, right? Because it's got to stay on a spoon. That's not so easy, man. Let me tell you.
No wonder my rice pudding sucks.
I'm telling you, it is not something to be taken lightly. It is, you know, I knew a guy, and he was not Greek. You know, to me, the Greek rice pudding in the diner, you know, that's in that glass case with the meringue, and it's usually got like that crosshatch pattern of cinnamon on it.
Oh.
It is so delicious. But you don't talk to anyone that's made rice. Can we get your mom on the phone?
I'm sorry. No one can get her on the phone. Maybe God can.
Okay. Well, the next time you get the family together, you put the screws to the relatives and you find out how she made it, because I would be dying to know how she made it. There's so many things. What kind of rice?
Well, it was definitely white rice, probably Uncle Ben's.
Okay, so that's a converted rice. That's like a parboiled rice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I like to refer in the business as crap rice. That's crap rice.
Oh, I was going to say that. Yeah, that's, absolutely. But man, is it good. I mean, I'm talking 1968. If I didn't want to eat something, my mother would say, you know, there are children starving in China. I think that was the standard back then.
Yes, China. Yeah, we got
that. And she said, some kids only get a bowl of rice for breakfast. And I was like, oh, that sounds awesome.
A bowl of rice for breakfast. Yeah, my mother made Uncle Ben's rice pretty much, without fail. That was the rice. Or there was another rice that was also in the cabinet. It was called minute rice.
Oh yeah, it was either one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't take that long to cook. I remember distinctly being in culinary school. I went to the Culinary Institute of America, and one of the chefs was at the counter, and he was talking about rice, and he had a box of Uncle Ben's rice in his hands, and he says, "Can any of you cooks out there tell me how to make this rice?" And everyone is like, "Oh, well, it's two parts water, one part rice. Bring the water to a boil and add a teaspoon of butter or whatever." And he's like, he went through the whole class. Everyone offered their opinions on how to cook the rice. And he said, "Wrong. No." He
dropped it in the garbage.
"No. Wrong. No." Wrong. One after the other. And after he went through the whole class, he said, "You know how to make this rice?" And he turned the box around and he said, "Follow the directions."
Oh.
"Follow the directions. It's not rocket science."
Why? Because they know exactly how to make it. There's no variation.
Do you think Uncle Ben's, Uncle Ben, wherever he was, when he invented the rice, he didn't have specific directions on how to cook it?
I don't know. I think he didn't, because, I mean, you just talked about not using a thermometer, using your hand. How is that a specific direction?
Well, there are nuances to cooking.
Right.
However, if you were to put 2 cups of rice in a pan with a half cup of water and a little butter and set it to boil, the results would be very disappointing.
I'm cracking up. My cooking is very simple. Food is not top on my priorities list. But I love the passion, and I love how, you are.
Do you cook rice?
Yeah. I used to just make brown rice in a big pot, and my wife got a rice cooker, and it's just so easy, and it makes it better than I usually do. So
can I tell you, the rice cooker is like, oh my God, it's like I had my cataracts removed.
Yeah.
I put rice in that pot, whatever rice it is, and whatever liquid goes in it, just a little bit over the top, and season it with something, press that button. And when that thing pops up, the rice,
magic.
The rice is perfect.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're not too much of a snob to poo-poo that.
No, not at all. No, anyone that's anyone has to use a rice cooker. If you don't have a rice cooker in this day and age, you are mired in hobbyism.
Right. Okay.
Which is not what we want. And hats off to you, my friend, for eating a whole grain on a regular basis. I'm a firm believer in, I love short grain brown rice. It is absolutely delicious.
Well, I do enjoy hearing about how you cook the meat and everything, although I am a vegan and vegan vegetarian for the past 33 years.
That's awesome.
I know that wouldn't be something that you'd want to do, but what do you think about that?
No. Hey, I do not. Yeah. I do not cast aspersions at our non-meat eating friends. I'm a big. Mm-hmm. I love Ayurvedic cooking. I love Indian food. I love all things vegetable. And whenever I make sides for barbecue, like I make collard greens, if they have meat in them, they're always go on the menu as dirty collard greens.
Bro.
But I do make wonderful collard greens sans meat, and I'm quite proud of them. It doesn't have to have meat in them.
Well, that's awesome. I've noticed that if I go to a wedding or something or some place where there is no vegetarian thing on the menu, they'll often just make something. I think they probably get excited that they get to be creative. They're not just cranking out the same stuff.
I always got excited by having to prepare vegetables for someone.
Well, that's awesome.
I love that.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Hey, and if you ever get that bread, that rice pudding recipe,
I will send.
You go to the top of the list. Hi, you're on the air. What do you got for me?
Well, since the conversation has drifted to rice, what you were saying, SK, we have a rice cooker, and it's full of oven mitts. That's how often I use it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It makes a great dog dish, too.
Yeah, okay. It's just like, I grew up with one kind of rice.
And that was?
And this was, it wasn't specifically any kind of, it wasn't a box of rice. It was either bulk rice from the supermarket, whatever that was, or just like one of those skinny little bags in the rice department.
Oh, you mean the flavored ones, like the Spanish one that has like a little bit of turmeric in it?
Well, it was just basic rice.
Like a sock of rice.
Yeah, okay. What happened next, and this is from observation, purely from observation, there was no recipe. It was just all about watching how it was done. My mother and my grandmother.
Sure.
First, the rice, without rinsing it off, is browned in a pan, in your preferred rice pan. We had several of them, until it's with garlic, very, very finely minced garlic. Once it had a sort of a toasty edge on it, you can't burn it. You really have to pay attention because it goes off real quick. And then the other elements were added, chopped bell pepper, onion, and then tomato sauce or raw tomatoes. And it was Mexican rice.
Oh.
And there was nothing to it. There was nothing. It's just like, this is the way you made rice. And that I continued making rice like that forever. And my sister, who apparently wasn't as observant in the kitchen, and she goes, how do you make rice? It's like, what do you mean? Weren't you in the kitchen when my mom or my grandmother was making rice? It's just that. It's nothing else. But toasting it with the garlic and black pepper is very crucial, you know, and then everything follows from there. And it'll turn out something that doesn't resemble any other kind of rice.
Well, I must interject. You said toast the rice with garlic, but did you say, was there fat in the pan with the rice?
Well, no. Oh, I'm sorry. See, because I do everything. It's just like subliminal. Of course, cooking oil.
Right, cooking
you know?
Oil.
Not olive oil. Later on, of course, I started using olive oil. And So you were just lightly toasting it. It would smoke a little bit, but it wasn't really that bad. But, you know, we didn't have olive oil at home when I was a kid. It was like Wesson oil.
That was the oil that we had in the my mother would make. My mother only had Wesson oil. Yeah. I don't even think my mom knew about olive oil.
Well, I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't until I had a girlfriend that really took me to the next level. Because she lived in New Orleans above the Tip Top grocery store.
Oh, wow.
And so she came back to California with all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, when she showed me how to make a roux.
Wow.
You know, and that was it. I dumped my other girlfriend and I'm like, okay, let's be a couple. And, you know, and it's like, because food is everything.
You followed your stomach.
But you got to have food.
Yeah, you gotta have food. Since I'm concerned with accuracy, the tomato product that would go on top of the toasted rice with the garlic and the bell pepper was a canned product or fresh?
Well, you know, back in the day, it was like Hunt's. Okay, now I never once I started cooking at home, I modified it and I only used fresh tomatoes.
Right.
You know, I just spelled with, or, you know, or sun-dried tomatoes work too. I mean, it's kind of a different finish, but it'll work.
But what? But when you say Hunt's, I mean, if you go to the Hunt's aisle in the supermarket, your head will pop off. There's like 50 different kinds of tomatoes in the Hunt's aisle. There's whole peel. There's puree.
It's more astounding than the breakfast cereal aisle.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah. Now I just I don't like. But you know, we had that. We used to make it at the Italian restaurant. You know, and so that was when I was a teenager. So I saw that there was a different approach to making tomato sauce. You know, I said, well, the way a Sicilian makes tomato sauce is not the way a Mexican makes tomato sauce.
Correct.
I was a Sicilian. And he had a very specific way. And, you know, and I would just watch the guys, you know, and there was one Portuguese guy working in the restaurant and he was a seasoned cook, but there was always a lot of friction between the guy from Portugal and the guy from Sicily.
Interesting.
About how to do stuff.
Wow.
And I would just stand there at the sink, like, you know, really amused by these two, like, old men
drinking it all in,
their teeth at each other on how to make things.
Wow.
You know? And they were both extremely good cooks. They just had a different, you know, approach. And I don't, you know, Sicilians are Italians, and Italians tend to, my experience in Italy, they're oblivious to other kinds of food. They, other types of food don't exist. I think I saw one Chinese restaurant in Rome.
Right.
You know, and it's like they don't care what the French think of them, because the French, of course, are very sort of denigrating about Italian food, but Italians don't care.
That's interesting that you say
that. They have this kind of this history to go back on with cooking that goes back to, you know, I don't know, Caesar?
I was talking with my partner before the show, and I related to him that I was, I just finished the reading the autobiography of Jacques Pepin, famous.
Oh, yeah.
Jacques Pepin. And
I remember watching him on TV.
I loved watching. I could still watch him, but interestingly enough, in his history, he was the corporate chef for Howard Johnson's restaurant chain back in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And it was his job.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was his job to make standardize these recipes for the stores. And he was responsible for replacing dehydrated potatoes in their chowder and adding fresh onions to it as opposed to dried onions. And he included in the book his recipe for New England clam chowder. And I read this recipe and my head popped off and I was taken aback because it included garlic. And
yeah.
I don't know, man. I don't know, Jacques, if you're out there, I don't know if garlic belongs in New England clam chowder. I mean, there's a couple things that I strongly feel belong in New England clam chowder, and someday we'll talk about that. Or if you want to talk about it now, garlic is not one of them.
For me, the standard was, since I live on the West Coast, you know, and the West Coast versus the East Coast, but Spanger's in Berkeley, you know, big family style restaurant that was open probably in the 40s. It's unfortunately not there anymore, but I would eat one thing there, clam chowder.
Right.
And I don't know.
White clam chowder.
I never really thought about how it was made. I wasn't going to make it at home. I was going to go to Spanger's in Berkeley.
But it was white, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That brothy Manhattan clam chowder?
Yeah.
Not for me.
Okay.
Not a great fan of it.
Okay. Eating is a very subjective thing, isn't it, Alan?
I totally agree.
Okay.
And you can't dispute that it's subjective. No. So the phone number today is 201-209-9368. I'll take a minute to do what I'm mandated to do by law. You are listening to WFMU at 91.1 FM. WFMU East Orange in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online. Yes, there's a radio in your computer. Did you know that? We're online at WFMU.org. And we have a comments board. You're more than welcome to suggest something for me to talk about or complain. Although I am chagrined by the comments about the plastic on top of the bread pudding, I'm going to look into that. If it is something that I shouldn't be doing, I definitely don't want to do it. I just have to figure out an alternative that's airtight. Other than that, I did have two thoughts when the guy was talking about the toasting of the rice in the pan, and we have a caller. You're on the air. What?
Hello, Alan.
What do you have to enthrall me with?
Well, I wanted to say I also love my rice cooker. Would not want to be without it.
Isn't it amazing?
It's a total game changer. And if I had to give away many things, that would not be one of them.
That's the one kitchen appliance, yeah. I never see at a garage sale because everyone loves them.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Okay, I was wondering, I think you asked for new subjects, and I just used the air fryer that's in our new oven for the first time while I was listening to your show, and I thought, I don't know if you have any experience with air fryers, but I'm sure some in the audience have experience, and I would love it if next week we could talk about air fryers.
I'm writing that down for next week because you know what air frying to me is?
What?
Necromancy. I don't know how it works. Oh. When I was in the restaurant business, yeah. When I was in the restaurant business and I was first starting out, the chef would say, oh, I want you to go down the street to the other guy's restaurant and ask him if you can borrow the chicken boning machine, right? So he sent me down the street to borrow the chicken boning machine,
okay.
Right? And the guy gave me like a backpack with like four number 10 cans of sauerkraut in it. And he said, here you go, bring it back. And he brought it back. And everyone started cracking up because I was a boob because there's no such thing as a chicken boning machine. And that's the way I feel about air frying. I don't know. How can you fry in air? You need fat to fry.
I don't know.
There's no fat in an air fryer, right?
Say it again. There's what?
Is there like a secret reservoir that you fill up with oil?
No. Okay. I just did it in the oven. It's the first time I used the oven. We just got it the other day.
Are you saying your oven in your house has an air frying button?
Yes. It's kind of, you know, it's a little bit fancy. It's new and whatever. We used our American Express points to buy it. It was more expensive than we normally would have paid.
Okay. Now
this is the last one for life. This is the last oven we'll ever buy.
Okay. And what did you successfully air fry?
Green beans, green beans, which I parboiled first.
You parboiled them in salted water.
Yes.
And then you cooled them and refreshed them in cold water.
I didn't do that.
Okay.
The recipe said, yeah, you don't really have to do that. So
after they were boiled, they went into a bowl and got coated with fat.
Well, no.
Okay.
While they were in the sieve, when I drained the water, I shook the water out as much as possible, a lot, and then I took very little, I want to say a teaspoon at most of olive oil, and then a bunch of salt and pepper, and then I just spread them out on this kind of basket thing that came with the oven, and they went in there, and they were in there for, I don't know, it didn't take any less time. I mean, I usually just bake, you know, green beans. I just really like them roasted or whatever, and so I thought, oh, you know, my daughter's really into the air frying. Let me give it a try. There was nothing spectacular about it, so I want somebody to call in next week.
Oh, you want someone to tell you
air frying is better than roasting.
You want someone to rationalize the purchase of your air fryer.
No. Well, I didn't even know there was an air fryer in this thing until it came. It's a induction stove, so that was kind of the main draw.
You got your wish. We're doing an air frying expose next week when you visit me. At Is It Soup Yet? Again, my name's Alan Harding. This is It Soup Yet? comments board, ideas for shows. Take care. Brush your hair. Stand tall. Thank you.
The 411 tablespoons of all in Memphis guitar now. Carnell Dupree from Fort Worth, Texas on the guitar.